So good evening, everyone, and Happy New Year. There's something about the transition, at least for me, I don't know for you, over these holidays and the new year, that the time away feels like a long time. I don't know. I guess I have been gone for a couple of weeks, but it feels like I've come back from a long trip or something. So here we are. And bravely going into 2007, and as a support for the path of 2007, I'd like to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. It's my custom to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths as the first talk of every year, and so I did yesterday Sunday morning, and I'll do today here, and. I like doing it because it's really like one of the core teachings of Buddhism. It said that this teachings of the Four Noble Truths, all of Buddhism, all the different teachings of Buddhism can be summarized within the Four Noble Truths. And so you hear tonight's talk, then you have it for the year. There is a story from the Chinese Buddhist tradition. I think it's probably somewhat true, but there seems to have been this monk who was kind of a character, I suppose, or it's a little bit unusual for his time, and that decided or made a vow to just sit up in a tree, and just that's what he's going to do. And so he was just living up in his tree, doing his thing in the tree, and I think the governor of the province came to see him one day, and I said, "What are you doing up there?" And finally, he said to him, "You know, what's the core teachings of Buddhism?" And so the tree monk said, gave him a little short description of the Four Noble Truths. And the governor was kind of indignant and said, maybe because he was really important, right? Well educated, and he said, "You know, any child knows that. Any child can understand that teaching." And the tree monk said, looking down, said to him, I guess, said, a child can understand it, but even a person of 80 might not realize it. So there's a big difference between understanding it and realizing it. And in fact, this teaching, which I'll give you in a little bit on the Four Noble Truths, are said only to really be understood when you become fully awakened, fully liberated. So until then, you don't really understand it. So since I'm not fully awakened, I'll talk about what I don't know. And they say that, also in Zen, they say that Zen masters, they have very long eyebrows. Because it's kind of like in Japan, that's like the Pinocchio principle. You know, instead of long nose, if you lie a lot, your eyebrows grow. And since it's so, it's been Zen, at least, so impossible to teach accurately, you're always off the mark a little bit. These Zen masters have long eyebrows. So, and here's another story, a once upon a time story of a monastery where at the beginning of every year the abbot had the custom of going, gathering up all the young monks or the new monks who had entered the monastery during the last year, since the last beginning of the year. And he gathered them together and he said, you know, please pack all your gear, all your bags, because I'm going to take you on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of the Buddha. So for a Buddhist monk, that's a great thing. You know, you get to go on a pilgrimage to the holy sites, going to Mecca, the Buddhist Mecca. And so the monks, assumed that they were really delighted that they had anticipated they'd have a chance, especially so early in their monastic life, to go off to India, especially with the abbot, and get to go on this, you know, tour of the Buddhist holy sites. So they were quite excited, and they all packed, and the day came to set forth on their pilgrimage. And Abbot led the way, and the first thing he did was he took them to a hospital. And they spent the time hospital visiting the sick, and the monks were a little bit surprised to see the wide range of illnesses that could keep people in hospital. And when they had done that for some hours, then they continued on their pilgrimage and they went to a old age home. And especially the younger monks were amazed how old people could become. And that was kind of new. And then, after a few hours there, they went for another trip, and they went to a hospice. And they were amazed at all the different ways people can die, how people are close to death, and how they are at the moment of death, and how they are after they've died, seeing the corpse there. And so the monks saw that. And then the abbot took them back to the monastery. And took them to, first he took them to the infirmary. And there, in fact, was a monk who was quite sick. And when they went to say hello to him, the new monks were surprised. Wonderful sparkle of delight were in the eyes of the monk who was in the infirmary, who was a sick monk. And then they went to the to visit the oldest monk in the monastery, some fellow who was 102 and bent over. And they were amazed because not only was he old, but he seemed so happy, all gnarled. And then they went to the monastery, had a little hospice. And in fact, that day there was that period of time there was a monk who was dying there. And so they got to meet, you know, this monk, one of their compatriots on the path, and they found that this monk was, they were amazed at how much peace he had. He was completely equanimous about his imminent death. And so that was the pilgrimage to the holy sites of Buddhism. What do you think of that? The monks were a little bit surprised at first that they were going to India. But whatever you find in India is not really the holy sites of Buddhism. But really the holy sites that really made a difference in the Buddha's life was his encounter with sickness, old age, and death, and his encounter with a renunciant, someone who offered an alternative, another way of being. And this is the teachings of the Buddha were meant to address at the heart these kinds of issues, the deep existential issues, the deep issues of suffering in our life that are represented by sickness, old age, and death. And so the Four Noble Truths can be applied in many different ways, but if we can treat them quite lightly and just kind of as a form of stress reduction, but that's not what they're meant with. They're meant to be deeply transformative. I believe that most religions, for many people, many people's involvement in religions is their attempt to try to find some way to deal with some of the deeper existential issues that they have. One of the deep issues is the issue of death. And so not a few people are interested in religion providing them with answers to the question of what happens at death, what happens after death. They want to be reassured that there's an afterlife. They want to be reassured that in that afterlife that there's something good's going to happen to them. Going to heaven. And I think it was in this week's paper, I read an article about, it was a magazine article about the phenomenal growth of the Mormon Church across the world, one of the fastest growing religions in the world in the last 100 years or so. And at least the journalist who wrote about it said that one of the reasons why it's growing so fast is that it provides people with a very positive view about what can be possible after you die. That after you die, you know, if you baptize all your past relatives, you know, who are no longer dead, everybody gets reborn in some wonderful heaven after they die. And so there's hope for some kind of salvation in afterlife. And I don't think necessarily it's true for the Mormons, but it's been pointed out by scholars of religion that that often people who are most oppressed who fought, you know, who are very poor, very oppressed in their life, and they don't see any hope, any possibility of getting out of their oppressed poverty or difficulty in this lifetime, will put their hope in a future lifetime. And so then they love religious doctrines and teachings that are pointing to some kind of salvation that's going to come in the next lifetime. So there's some kind of this issue of death, the issue of sickness and suffering. It's something that all religions are trying to address in some way or other. And like other religions in that way, Buddhism is also trying to address this. But rather than looking to a solution in the afterlife, rather than looking to a solution as something that's going to be given to us from some God that's going to give it to us, or some belief from the outside we have to adopt and make this belief myself, my own, Buddhism offers a path, a practice, a path of inner transformation that involves a very radical thing in the world of, I think, most religions. I don't know that much about a lot of religions. I should be careful, I guess, what I say about other religions. But I believe it's a pretty radical thing. And what Buddhism offers is that we take responsibility for our suffering. We take responsibility for the transformation or the solution to addressing some of the deepest fundamental existential issues that face a human being. The deepest psychological issues, deepest emotional issues that we have. That we take responsibility for that. We don't look externally for it. We might look externally for, you know, it's like, you know, if you want to drive to Seattle, you have to take responsibility for driving there. You don't sit in your living room and expect to get there unless you drive, I suppose. But you get some help, you get a map, and so you find your way. So in the same way, or in a similar way, the Buddha offers a map or a description or a pointer on how you can take that, this kind of very deep personal responsibility. Some people don't want that because it's much more comforting to know that someone else is going to do it for you. Someone else is going to kind of, it's already provided for you. All you have to do is kind of believe or put your faith in something, and then you're taken care of. Salvation by grace. And so in some ways, Buddhism is not very comforting. And because, you know, there's no one to turn to exactly who's going to do it for us. We have to do it for ourselves. And at least within Buddhist circles, you know, I think of Buddhist practice as a process of growing up. And that each of us, you know, are learning to grow up in a way that we take responsibility for ourselves in some very deep way. So now, the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, in the most simple way of being stated, say there's a noble truth of suffering. There's a noble truth of the origin of suffering. There's a noble truth of the cessation. And there's a noble truth of the path. So, suffering, the origin, the cessation, and the path. Sometimes you find in Theravadan Buddhism, people will just, you know, rely on those four words to describe the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation, and the path. So the first one, suffering, is a teaching that in this life, there is suffering that we'll encounter. It doesn't say that life is suffering, as some popularizers of Buddhism in the West have claimed. The Buddha never said that, because then there's no hope, right? If life is suffering, that's, you know, then the solution is in the afterlife. But what it says is there is suffering. That's all. It's a very simple statement. But actually, it's a little bit more developed than that. It says there's suffering, but it says there is the noble truth of suffering. And that's a different thing than saying there is suffering. It says there is a noble truth of suffering. And so what is it that transforms suffering from just ordinary suffering that pulls us down and drains us and noble suffering? One of the description, noble, supplies that it has respect. It's respectworthy or dignifying or ennobling or sacred. So there's something about suffering that make it sacred. And what is that? That's the question. You know, what is it that can make suffering sacred? This is not a teaching that you should go out and just suffer for, you know, look for your suffering so you can be more sacred. What it's saying is that when you suffer, which you might do occasionally, then there's a way of relating to that suffering that can be ennobling, that can be respect-worthy, or can be sacred. It's a way of, if you're going to suffer, then you can transform it into something sacred. Or to say it a different way, you can transform it into a path of sacred transformation, a transformation into a sacred dimension of your mind or your heart. So the noble part implies that there's a possibility in that suffering. The truth part is not a creed. It's a little bit confusing for people in the West sometimes when they hear the idea of a truth. It's Four Noble Truths. It's something that's meant to be made true through your practice. The map to Seattle is supposedly true map, right? But you don't really know the truth of that map unless you drive up there. Then you know the truth of the map works. So the Four Noble Truths are meant to be something to realize for yourself. They're pragmatic truths rather than philosophical truths or doctrinal proofs. So there's something we have to kind of engage in to find out for ourselves if they're true. To simply think that they're true as a doctrine and philosophy, that's kind of empty. It doesn't have much meaning. We have to kind of enter into them and realize them. So the first thing then to do is to realize suffering. And this is the bad news of Buddhism, which, half of you are probably ready to go. And this is the teaching that it's really helpful if what you want is to find this path of responsibility, find the path of transformation, find the path, as the Buddha was pointing towards, liberation. You have to learn to stop for your suffering and study it, get to know it. And this is counterintuitive. My friend John Travis was teaching a mindfulness-based stress reduction class at a hospital once. And this retired police officer from Los Angeles was taking the class. And he was in chronic back pain, very, very bad. And the doctors in the hospitals had not been able to help him. So he took this class on mindfulness-based dealing with the pain. And the first thing, in the first day, John told the class, turn your attention and really look and feel that pain. And the guy was furious at John. I'm here to get away from it, to stop it. And you're telling me to feel it even more? And he was really upset. And I don't know how the story ended, whether eventually at the end of the course, whether he got the idea. But the idea is there's something can be learned by going into the pain and feeling it, the suffering. We learn about the causes of it. We learn about the conditions that bring it about. If you don't learn the causes and conditions of your suffering, you might be doomed to repeat it. It might come back and come back and come back. And not a few people I know have stepped out of one or escaped, run away from their suffering, only to have their mind, only to have their mind follow them. Have you noticed that? So your mind, if it has certain habits of behavior, habits of thinking, habits of relating to what's going on in the world, if you take your mind with you, then you'll be revisited by the same problems, just in different guise, perhaps. So the idea is the first noble truth is to stop and look at it, get to know it. And one of the things that we're trying to get to know is the origins of it, or the cause of it. What is it gives rise to it? And that's the second noble truth. What is the cause? And the Buddha summed it up that the cause of suffering is, he used the word thirst. synonyms might be craving, grasping, drivenness, compulsion. The words drivenness and compulsion are interesting because some of you might have noticed that you can't just snap your fingers and put an end to your suffering very quickly. Maybe sometimes you can, if it's light enough. But sometimes it's a mystery to us. What's going on? Why is this hanging in there? Why am I kind of, hour after hour, day after day, why am I so depressed or so upset or so angry or so afraid? Or what's going on? I know I should just drop it, but why, what's going on? And so without having some sense of what the origin is, it's very hard to let something go and drop it. So the idea is to study it to see what the origins are. Oh, I lost track. So the idea of what keeps it going is that sense of compulsion. There's a compulsion in the mind, a compulsive momentum that's keeping it locked in, keeping it going. We can't just drop that momentum that easily because of the compulsion that's there. So the Buddha used the word thirst. And now it's kind of a tautology, which is a philosophical term for, I think it's for a term that defines itself. So the definition of suffering that the Buddhism is trying to address is that suffering that arises because of your thirsting, of your grasping, your clinging. If you have suffering that doesn't arise out of grasping, Buddhism doesn't address it. You're left with it. Now, certainly physical pain, for example, might have some element that you might not be grasping into it at all. But if you're not grasping it at all, my suggestion to you is that then you'll be peaceful, at peace with your physical pain. You won't be bothered by it as much. And what people tend to be bothered with around pain is not the pain, but rather is the relationship to it, all the things that are associated with it. So the second noble truth is the truth of the origin of it, which is in thirst and craving. And then there's a very interesting list of three forms of craving, which the Buddha used to define thirst, or to describe them. The first, and these are kind of like, I think of them as not necessarily representing all forms of craving, but rather they represent some of the deepest seated cravings that are kind of can be in a person's heart or mind that really hold one in the grip of thirsting, a desire of suffering. Some of the deepest rooted ones. And the idea in Buddhism, the word root is very important, because if you want to get rid of a weedy plant and you take off the leaves, the plant might just keep growing. If you take off some of the stems, it might keep growing. Some weeds, in fact, if you cut it off at the ground level, it sprouts up from the roots. What you have to do is you have to uproot it. The Bermuda grass, you have to uproot the roots and throw them away, far away, burn them or something. So there's these roots in our minds that unless we pull these kind of weeds up by the roots, they'll keep sprouting. Or if you let go of only the surface manifestation, they'll keep reappearing from the roots. So the three roots of this thirsting, the first is called sensual desire. And it's a little bit surprising for some people perhaps to realize, maybe embarrassing or kind of, how amazingly powerful sensual desire is in the human world. A lot of people cause and experience a lot of suffering based on their sensual desire. Jack Kornfield, when he talks about the third precept, which is not to engage in sexual misconduct, we'll ask for a show of hands. I won't ask since I don't want to embarrass you. But he'll ask a show of hands and say, who here has not made a fool of themselves through their sexuality? Now, down here on the peninsula, I know this, not so many people have. What? I'm under illusion. But who hasn't caused suffering through their sexuality? So that's an example of sensual desire. Sexuality is one kind. There's a sensual desire of, other kinds of desires for pleasure of various kinds. There's a kind of confusion of pleasure for happiness that sometimes is involved in addiction, alcohol and drugs and other things that might happen. So, sensual desire is a very powerful motivator for human beings. And people will do tremendously foolish things and tremendously painful things, awful things to other human beings in that pursuit for sensual pleasure. The second thirst that the Buddha talked about is called the thirst for existence. And this is an interesting term. The thirst for existence. Isn't it okay to exist? It's fine to exist, but the craving and clinging to exist can cause a lot of problems. And it's one of these roots, deeply rooted. In Buddhism, we say this includes things like the drive the compulsion to have an to hold on to some identity. You know, I need to be a good father. I need to be a good Dharma teacher. So I better give a good talk today. So that's a craving to exist in a certain way in your eyes or in my eyes. And so the craving to exist as have a certain identity is an example. The craving for status is a craving to exist in a certain way. The craving for accomplishment, the craving to bring something into existence, is a kind of deep-seated craving. The craving to have something that will survive your death. Some people like to make something, put something in motion, so that they can have something that continues after they're dead, because then somehow they still exist, or somehow it, you know, something. It can be a very powerful drive in people's minds. The drive to procreate, to have children, is understood to be kind of part of, can be part of this drive, this thirsting for existence, to create existence, to make something happen. And now there's nothing wrong with having children, but I think you have to admit that it's not so far from people's psyches. For some people's psyches, a tremendous drive, drivenness, thirsting to have children. And you see it most clearly, the people who are frustrated in their attempts to have children. And it's very, very painful for some people to have it, to have that. And it's not something that's easy to put down, you know, and people go through great struggles, you know, to have children. And the interesting thing about all these kinds of thirsting to exist is that they're so deeply rooted in us that they can feel like they're really essential parts of being a human being. Like, in order to be a human being, a successful human being, that these need to be fulfilled. And it's like, you know, it's like just as natural as breathing air. So it's natural to have these very deep drives. That this, you know, in order to be a person, not just to be a successful person, in order to be a person, I have to kind of somehow have these drives to exist in some form or other. And sometimes people are unwilling to drop these clinging, these drives, because they feel like it's who they are. Or there's a kind of a blindness that sets in where the possibility of letting go of those is unacceptable. Even though letting go of it means peace. There's a kind of holding on and clinging to something that causes a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. So it's a very interesting kind of attachment. And the third thirst is the thirst for non-existence. And this is a form of, takes the example of aversion, pushing things away, kind of cutting things down, not wanting something to be there. In the terms of identity, some people have a tremendous drive not to have an identity. You know, not to, you know, don't, you know, just kind of, every time someone tries to build them up or see them a certain way, they kind of knock it down, not to be seen in a certain way. Some people want to become invisible or become like nobody. Some people, it's also the drive to destroy things. Some people, there's a tremendous drive, hostility even, to make things go away or destroy them. In an extreme form, it could also be a desire for suicide, the desire for non-existence. Non-existence has to be better than what I have now, is the argument. Whatever comes next has to be better than this. In Buddhism, Buddhism very clearly argues or believes that that's not the case, that suicide is never really a solution, escape, that kind of escape. But that drive for non-existence can be very, very powerful in people. So we're not just dealing with kind of surface. The Four Noble Truths are not meant to kind of surface. You know, I'm attached to ice cream, and you know, it's, or I'm attached to, you know, watching my favorite television programs. We're talking about something really deep, and if you have a sense how deep it is in the psyche, then maybe you could intuit what the alternative is. And the alternative is some very deep uprooting, transformation, revolution in the mind that leads to a very deep abiding sense of peace and well-being and happiness. And one of the really remarkable things about the human heart or mind is that it's possible for the human heart and mind to be amazingly happy and peaceful for no reason. Isn't that something? Now, what good is that? What good is that if it has no reason? So, but the mind is, you know, there's this kind of centrifugal force outwards, or this kind of activity outward, to get and acquire and fix and build up identity or protect identity or defend or apologize for our existence, and all this movement that is kind of compulsive. And all that can be put down. All that can be, it can cease. The technical Buddhist word is cease. It can come to cessation of it. You can stop clinging. And that ending of clinging, ending of grasping, is the good news of Buddhism, because it's really beautiful. Now, some people might argue that, well, it's nice that you guys, the Buddhists, are peaceful. But, you know, it's nothing compared to what my religion offers. You know, grand glory, you know, in the afterlife, union with the great cosmos, whatever. So maybe Buddhists have kind of like, you know, a lesser ultimate goal. Maybe it's not so good compared to what others can offer. But it has the virtue of being something that you can prove to yourself. That's pretty good, I think. It's something experiential. Also, once you realize cessation, once you realize this liberation and freedom, it changes very much the motivations or the interest in other kinds of issues. So maybe you can get a sense of it from this way. Many people are interested in the meaning of life. It's a worthwhile pursuit in some ways. What's the meaning of your life? What's the meaning of life? However, from a Buddhist point of view, a more interesting question than what's the meaning of life is the question, why are you asking? What's motivating you to ask that question? And for some people, what's motivating them is fear. For some people, it's motivating a sense of emptiness, hollowness, unfulfillment. For some people, what's motivating them is maybe some kind of desire for existence, for becoming. You know, we talked about that. But if these kinds of desires, if fear is kind of a form of compulsion, if all the compulsions and drivenness are worked through and let go of, then you know, those very motivations for asking the question disappear. Then, would you still ask the question, what's the meaning of life? Or, you know, what's the significance of asking the question, or how would you approach that question if you no longer have a compulsion to find meaning? Then you could argue, well, if I don't have any meaning, then I'm going to be one of these Buddhist blobs. You know, and I just sit around, you know. Buddhist couch potatoes. These Buddhists don't have televisions, but they just, this is what's beautiful about being a Buddhist, right? You can just sit around. The Buddhists sit, right? So you just get rid of the television, you sit in the couch. Look at the wall. You know, endlessly look at the wall. Couch potatoes. Buddhist couch potatoes. Because there's no meaning, right? That doesn't mean that way at all. There can be meaning. And there can be tremendously motivating meaning to be found in a liberated life. But it doesn't have to arise out of a sense of neediness, a sense of emptiness, a sense of fear, a sense of ego. All the kind of compulsions of the mind have dropped away. And what's replacing it with is not a compulsion, but rather response. Rather than reactivity, is a choice of how to respond to the world that we live in. And one of the primary motivators for Buddhists, for people who become awakened, is compassion. Feeling the suffering of the world and wanting to respond to it. So because liberation, cessation, is not an easy thing to do, because these things are so deeply rooted in our psyche, the fourth noble truth is a truth of the path to do this. It's called the Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path. And this is what you can do so you can live your life to put together the conditions that allows you to, in time, reach your attention down into the foundation of your mind to do that inner house cleaning needs to be done to uproot these very difficult places of clinging. And one of the things that's beautiful about the Eightfold Path is that it's meant to be encompass all of our life. So it's not, it is not just to deal with one part of our life, you know, just the meditation part of our life, or just, the weekends. I'll be a weekend Buddhist. But rather, our full life is supposed to be engaged. If what you want is liberation, if you want full liberation for yourself, or as much as you can, then you want to make that a real priority. If it is your priority for your life, then here's a path that you can embrace or engage in as fully as you can. And the image of a path is the image, in the old days, a path is something you walked on. So the idea of a path, again, points back to the idea that we are supposed to walk the path. It's something that we do. We're not waiting for someone to do it for us. We're not waiting for someone else to kind of, you know, save us, but rather we're going to walk the path. We're going to do the walk ourselves. And so the Eightfold Path is the path. The first step of the Eightfold Path is to appreciate how valuable it is to enter into the world of suffering when we suffer through the framework of the Four Noble Truths. So if you're suffering, if you appreciate the value that it's helpful to stop for your suffering, to learn its origins, and either get a sense or actually discover the cessation of it. As opposed to suffering and blaming someone else. Blaming someone else is a popular pastime. And it's a contagious one. And sometimes there's some truth to it, that other people, you know, are causing difficulty. But you don't find the path to liberation by blaming someone else. You find other things, sometimes appropriate things. But you don't find the Buddhist path by blaming someone else for your suffering. You find the Buddhist path by studying what you are contributing to your suffering. And that's the mature, kind of adult-like thing that Buddhists ask themselves. What am I contributing to this? It doesn't mean we turn a blind eye to the world and the conditions of the world, what other people are doing. It's an important part of life to understand what goes on around us. But the Buddhist path is not found so much there. The Buddhist path is found by understanding, what is my contribution to this? And the amazing thing is that sometimes in the most horrendous situations, there have been shining examples of people who have taken responsibility for how they are and how they carry themselves. And they've been shining lights for humanity. Beautiful, I mean, sad, but very beautiful stories of people who spent years in the concentration camps and didn't allow that experience to somehow crush them. And then there are people who were crushed by it. It's possible for the human spirit to be larger than the conditions of the world. So the first of the Eightfold Path is, you know, really understanding the Four Noble Truths, this formulation. The second involves, at some at least primary, maybe beginning, rudimentary level, beginning to take some responsibility for the attitude which would you have, you know, your attitude. You know, you say, you know, he has a bad attitude, he has a good attitude, you know. Get your attitude together. So to somehow, you can, to the degree to which you could appropriately adjust your attitude, get it adjusted a little bit. So, you know, if you go into a kindergarten class or if you go to a funeral, most people naturally adjust their attitude. They usually have a very different attitude at the funeral than they do at Disneyland. You know, or a birthday party for a six-year-old. You know, it's kind of a different way of being, right? It's not so strange that you adjust yourself somewhat. And so in particular, what the Buddha said is that if what you want to do is find the path to liberation, it helps to have a certain attitude. Like if you study martial arts in Japan, sometimes you have to show that you have an attitude of respect for the teacher and the practice, otherwise they're not going to teach you. The assumption there is that without the attitude of respect, it's no good teaching you. So you have to come and find that respect in order to learn that art. So the attitude in Buddhism that's helpful or required is an attempt to have an attitude of being non-harming. So to go about your life not harming others, or try have an attitude, an approach, an orientation, a disposition that's going to be non-harming. Not easy to do, but at least that's kind of where you're leading. You're leading in that direction. This is how I want to live. So partly it's a decision. Yes, I'm going to try to do this. The other is a decision or an attitude not to be harsh, but instead to be harsh, to be kind or friendly. And the third one is the attitude of not blindly indulging in sensual pleasure, but rather appreciating a simplicity of being that's not grasped or caught in the vice of sensual desire. So those three attitudes are considered really helpful for being on the path. Then the next three aspects of the Eightfold Path have to do with our behavior and just how we behave in the world. So the first one has to do with our speech. So begin looking at how we speak. If all you did for your spiritual practice was to impeccably study what motivates you to say what you say, you would have a transformative spiritual path. You would learn so much about yourself if you simply looked at that. Why do I say what I'm about to say? So to pay attention to our speech is an important part of the path. The next one is pay attention to our ethics, how we behave in the world in terms of ethical guidelines. So not killing, not stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, and no indulging in intoxicants. Then the next one is the having a livelihood that's in harmony with being on a path to liberation. And that mostly is a matter for each person to find out. But most people spend a big chunk of their waking hours with livelihood issues. And is that livelihood in harmony with your attempt to be on a path or not? Then the last three mostly have to do with meditation, the Eightfold Path. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Right mindfulness is cultivating the ability to see very clearly as you can, into our life. And right concentration is the practice to stabilize the mind, focus the mind enough, still the mind enough, so that the mindfulness can be most penetrating. It's like if you want to look out a window, it's best to clean the window. So the concentration cleans the window, the mindfulness sees through. So that's the Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold Path. Excuse me, I know it's annoying. Is that better? I have something. But I want to, if you allow me, I want to tell you one more story. And then we can stop. If my voice holds up. So at the same monastery where they took the pilgrimage, they had a statue in the meditation hall of the Buddha that was rumored to speak occasionally. If you came with sincerity in front of the Buddha, in respect and sincerity, and if you had a lot of troubles in your life, if you came up with enough sincerity, really still, really quiet, in front of the Buddha, you'd hear it speak. So there was a person who was in fact suffering quite majorly. Big problems, big suffering. And I tried all kinds of solutions. Nothing seemed to work. So finally came to the monastery for kind of a spiritual solution. He's a very devout person, often visited the monastery to make donations and help in various ways in the monastery. But was really desperate for something, for help. And so the person came up to the statue and just got really still in front of the statue, hoping. I heard this rumor about the statue speaking. Maybe it'll speak to me and tell me what to do. So there it was in front of the statue. And then after a while, there was this little voice came out of the statue. But it was hard to hear, so the person got closer. And then could hear what the statue said was, "Why not?" It seems a strange thing to say. So the person listened more carefully, and the statue said, "Again, why not?" And first, the person didn't know what this about. The person expected some kind of great, profound teaching or instructions or guidance. Why not? And the person started thinking of all the excuses. Why not? I can't. Give me chastity, but later, right? Give me spiritual practice, but later. Why not? I'm not good enough. Why not? It's too hard. Why not? Later. Why not? So why not? Why not do it? That's the question. The story has a very sad ending. The person ran out of the monastery, never to be seen again. To be face to face to the question, why not, was too threatening, too frightening, too insurmountable for that person. I hope it's not for you. So, good luck in 2007. Thank you.